think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk. And maybe, after all of that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news, it doesn't have to be this way, thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all of your recurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something is coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel, or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
The Quest was a sailboat that got pirated, 19 pirates with four Americans on it. And I flew out to the Red Sea with Dev Group, the SEALs that were called out. Unfortunately, supposed to be a hostage rescue attempt. And the pirates ended up killing the four Americans in front of us. Literally, I'm on the Navy ship looking over, talking, having the translator talk to the pirates on a bullhorn when they killed them. SEALs tried to do an emergency assault. They're all dead by then. They flew them over to the aircraft carrier, but couldn't save them. Pirates killed two of their own when they were killing the hostages.
Hey, gang. Welcome back to part two of this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the morning. You know, I don't know why we say in the morning. It just sounded cool with Game of Crimes. My wife came up with that, and she's a whole lot smarter than I am. But welcome back. Our guest this week is Rob D'Amico. He is a 26-year veteran FBI special agent. He spent almost 29 years with the United States Marine Corps. This man's a patriot and a true American hero, ladies and gentlemen. We had gotten into his stories yesterday, and if you haven't listened to that, it would behoove you to go back and listen to that part before you listen to part two, just so you'll know where we are in this story. He's done his time working undercover on the DiCavalcante crime family up in New Jersey, which is the crime family that the Sopranos TV series was kind of patterned after. He's worked with Joe Pistone, who's a legend in his own right, Donnie Brasco. If you've never seen the movie, go watch that with Johnny Depp. That's an outstanding movie. And now he's been in the Bureau for a while, and he's joined their hostage rescue team. He's done a lot of different things on that. He was telling us yesterday about working with U.S. Army's Delta Force and the U.S. Navy SEAL Team 6, or what they call Development Group now, DevGru. We have some friends in common that we've worked with over the years. He was assigned to the Joint Special Operations Command out of Fort Bragg for a while. He's done some tours over in Afghanistan. I don't know. And not just one. I think you went over TDY and then went back as an assistant legal attaché, and then went back as the legal attaché. Is that right, Rob?
Yes. So as first 15 and 16, I was an assistant legal attaché in Bagram, and then went back in 18, 19, and 20 to be the legal attaché down in Kabul at the embassy.
I went to Afghanistan for a 2-week TDY, and that was plenty. I didn't leave anything there, and I never had a reason to go back. But I will tell you, the Hindu Kush Mountains, those are some of the most beautiful mountains I think I've ever seen. They were just awe-inspiring. So as I said, and when we closed out yesterday, my question for Rob today is, what is your most significant or your most exciting investigation in your own opinion that you got to participate in, especially as an HRT operator?
So I'd have to say it was the Quest. It was a sailboat that got pirated, 19 pirates with four Americans on it. And I flew out to the Red Sea with Dev Group, the SEALs that were called out. Unfortunately, it was supposed to be a hostage rescue attempt, and the pirates ended up killing the four Americans in front of us. Literally, I'm on the Navy ship looking over, talking, having the translator talk to the pirates on a bullhorn when they killed them. SEALs tried to do an emergency assault. They're all dead by then. They flew them over to the aircraft carrier, but couldn't save them. They killed two of the pirates. Pirates killed two of their own when they were killing the hostages. We arrested, I think, 15 of them, brought them back to the States. And then we ended up connecting the hostage negotiator who was on land in Somalia to the case. We had one of the HRT guys, Brian, had to get on the sailboat with two other Navy guys because the sailboat wasn't working, and got it working and sailed it back with the, you know, Navy escort back to Djibouti so we could process it as a crime scene. And then I met up with a guy doing who was doing some covert activity in Somalia that came across this Shibin guy, the negotiator, and had got his phone for a little while. End up they had to give it back, but he ended up didn't have his technical equipment to suck the phone dry, and he took, I think it was like 350 pictures of screenshots of everything, and a lot of it was incriminating him, searching how much the ship was worth, who she should call, all this stuff back and forth. So we had enough to build an indictment on him. And then he was in Somalia. We're planning. There was another covert group in there of Army, Navy, like SEALs, Rangers, and Delta dudes. And we're going to use them to go into Somalia, me and my HRT partners, to arrest this guy. And just when we finally got presidential State Department approval, he ends up fleeing. We find out he flees down to Zambia. Me and the other FBI guys, Brian and Lance, we go down to Pretoria, South Africa, because we don't have a league at in Zambia. We end up getting up to Zambia. We locate him. We're dealing with the Zambian intelligence service. And then we found out that he actually, the plane we flew in on to Zambia, he was actually a gate below us. It was like separated by first floor and second floor.
Yeah.
He was upstairs at the gate and flew out on the plane we flew in on. Oh. So we were like 30 feet. And then it turns out like he flew back and he was in a restaurant in Djibouti, and me and the SEAL commander and Brian had gone out to dinner, and he was like at a restaurant a quarter, like two blocks away. Like it was like after we got, so we end up locating him back in Somalia. We flew in, got special approval, and we end up, it was just a really crazy story, but we end up arresting him in Somalia. We flew him back to, we flew on a fixed wing, like just a kind of a blacked out aircraft, from Somalia back to Djibouti. We got on a Marine Corps helicopter. It's funny because I trained, part of my job when I was liaison to those special units, I also was a liaison to Marine Corps to help them set up training in urban cities so they could train. And it was, I taught a couple classes there, and it was the Marine unit that I taught like 6 months earlier was on the helicopter, and I come walking in carrying a Samsonite luggage. The you know, Shibin's luggage had evidence in it. So we took it. I got this big beard on because this is going on for 2 months now. I haven't shaved. And you know, two FBI HRT guys with this, you know, this skinny pirate and his Samsonite, and the Marines are looking at me like he looks familiar. And then they fly us out to the ship, because we could only stay in Djibouti like 2 hours at a time. So they flew us out to this Navy ship. We put him in the brig down there. And then the next morning, they got the FBI G5 coming in. So they fly us off the ship, back into Djibouti. We take him, bring him on the G5, get him home, and then end up testifying against him. And he got, I think, his 10 life terms plus 280 years.
Wow.
Yeah. And he was convicted of piracy on the high seas without being on the high seas, because we proved he had criminal knowledge of what was going on before the pirates left and went out on the high seas. So we tied him that. We tied him to a German vessel that he had kidnapped, and they had tortured some German citizens in front of him and some other stuff. I've done a couple. I did that story on Jerry Williams' podcast. That's a good 2 hour one that I go into it. Not to cut you short on it.
No.
It's a long story. It is crazy. They're trying to make a movie out of it. And I did, FBI True is a TV show about two agents talking in a bar, season 3, episode 8, but that one's only like 20 minutes. They really had to kind of cut that down.
Right.
And I did another podcast, Surviving the Survivor, a guy who does true crime stuff, did it on that one too. And that's about an hour and a half long. Cause that story is just, it's tiring to tell. It's crazy. The biggest thing was when he didn't even figure out exactly who we were. We didn't have to say when we came into Somalia to talk to him. We had all the facts. We knew he wasn't going to have his phone, but we had pictures of his phone with all the incriminating messages that he was doing on there and lookups and stuff. So we put him on like a picture portfolio, and we said, "Hey, is this your phone?" And he says, "Well, it looks like look at the scratches and all. Is that really your phone?" And he said, yes. So he signed that document. And we're like, with that phone, did you in fact do these searches? And he admitted to it and he signed that document. And we read him his rights every time we talked to him. And then we found proceeds from the German, receipts from the German vessel that he got money from. But getting him out of Somalia turned into a goat rope. And the Somali guy that we're dealing with, they don't mind pirates in Somalia. It's not like they don't like terrorists there. So we came in with the counter-terrorist group and we kind of threw the pirate thing at him at the last second. So the main commander didn't want to turn him over to us to bring him back, because now outside our base, and it's like only seven Americans and me and Brian, and everyone else is Somali, and they're starting to ruckus outside the base because like this guy's cousins and family and tribe and stuff are out there. And they're all thinking Black Hawk Down again, that this was going to be the overrun our base. So we came up a way to give Shibin to the Bosaso Police Department, and then tell them to bring him out to this airfield at midnight. And they agreed to it. Now, the president of Puntland, who was trying to get in with the U.S. government, is the one that was pushing to that to be done. So they agreed to it. I don't think we didn't give him enough time to figure everything out. It was like 4 hours from when we turned him over and he had to be out at the thing. And we might have slipped the tracker in his shoes so that we could figure out where he was. and we see him coming to the airport like, wow. So sure enough, we got a jet sitting there, you know, just plain white, blacked out. You can't even see, like you go in, we got it. So you can't see the pilots. You can't see anything. It's almost like it was, if I was doing Mob, I think it's a murder thing, like tarps down on the ground, you know, but it's all blacked out. Brian's on the stairs of the jet, and the Somali police bring him to me and they take his hood off. He had a hood on. And at that point he just knew me as Rob, worked for the U.S. government. So I have my FBI creds and I said, well, I'm Rob D'Amico with the FBI. You're under arrest for the murder of four Americans. And he looks at me and he seriously goes, are you going to kill me? And my instinct was, I look up because I knew at the time, like the White House Situation Room's watching this, JSOC headquarters watching this, like there's so many people watching this event. There's three layers of ISR, which is one was a predator with a camera, one was a manned aircraft, and then I think there was another predator. So there's three layers of ISR above us. And I could hear him. I know what a predator sounds like, so I could hear him. So when he said that, I kind of looked up and I said, actually, Mr. Shibin, I'm going to bring you back to the U.S. and you're going to stand trial just like anyone else. You are the safest person on this planet because I will not let anything happen to you. And it sounds corny, but that's the difference between us and everyone else.
Right.
We spent a lot of money to do this right. I mean, we could have just sent the SEALs to kill you. They would have happily done that. But we didn't. That was the difference. And it was one of those things. And he really couldn't understand that we'd do all this. He just literally thought I was going to shoot him, throw him off, and then get on the plane myself and leave. But that's not what we do. And that's, I think, the proudest thing is every agency helped me too. Like when we went to South Africa, when we went to Zambia, the CIA was helping us with everything. They heard the story like, hey, what can we do? The military, even though they were friends of mine, was still just doing everything they could. Admiral McCaven was a JSOC commander. Matt and Oli were the SEALs out for, like, it was just, everyone's like, what do you need? And we'll help you. And that's, I think, the best part of that story was that's what happened. And unfortunately, yeah, four Americans were killed to begin with, but that's what we do to protect our citizens and to provide justice for them.
Absolutely. That's what separates us from the rest of the world, pretty much.
Yeah.
Those type of actions. And it's, you know, I think you're cutting yourself a little bit short there when everybody's agreeing to cooperate you, because you've already built respect and trust with these people. And when they find out Rob's involved in a case, well, you know, here's a guy we've done missions with before. He's one of us. So it's amazing how that opens doors for you.
Yeah. And that's the biggest thing, because having worked with them, it was one of those things that trust is one trust in the operators down there, that you're not there to tell on them for something. You're there to help them type of thing. I always say, like, when you go with Delta or SEAL team, like, your first helicopter ride may be that they were ordered to take you. After that, you earn it, because yeah. no one gets on the helicopter without having proven their worth. Like, if you did nothing on the first mission, you're not going on the second mission.
Yep.
So it's one of those things. And then the other thing is, like, there's a lot of misconceptions in law enforcement and the military. Like, the FBI guys didn't think we could give the military photos. They're like, if we took on target, they're like, oh no, this is evidence. Like, no, I can give them a copy. I just have the original.
Yeah.
Like it's so crossing, and that I was involved in all that crossing the barrier. I helped in really when we started looking at when we were grabbing guys overseas and bringing them back to trial in the US, there's a whole thing like we had to do intelligence interviews that couldn't spill over to law enforcement. And how do you do that? And we just, we kind of made it up. Like when they first get on ship, we could do a long drawn out intelligence interview in this very plain room. And you had military interrogators there asking questions, no rights were read type of thing. And then when they were done, we would literally clear out the entire ship. And it was, again, augmented folks, not from the ship, but from the units I was working with, that did the guarding, that did the feeding, that did the interrogations. Everyone that guy saw was from that unit. We got them off the ship, and an entire new crew of guards, interrogators, people that fed them were brought in, so that no one who heard anything about the intelligence interviews could talk to the law enforcement team. Yeah, we called it a clean team and a dirty team, which is a, you know, like in court, you don't say dirty team because the defense lawyer's like, oh, dirty, what are you doing? It's just, we talk, the dirty side is the intelligence side, and then the clean side is law enforcement.
Right.
And they weren't even on the same ship. They didn't cross each other. They didn't talk to each other. And I always said, because we also had to prove to the courts that the person's ability to distinguish between the two was significant too. So if he was talked to for 2 weeks on the intelligence side, we would give him 5-7 days where he didn't talk to anyone. No one came in and talked to him. And then when the law enforcement team did come in, we changed the room. He went from a stark desk, metal chair, a desk, and a bottle of water to literally a couch, rugs on the floor, rugs on the wall, to, you know, food was much better. I always said, when you start serving soft serve ice cream, that's the law enforcement side. And literally, we did that. We went from Hawala meals to... law enforcement came in with soft serve ice cream from the Navy Chow Hall.
Wow.
And it was so, I like, that was the joke. I think Tony Thomas might have, like, that's who I was. It might have been like one of him's, like, soft serve ice cream. What are you kidding? I'm like, hey, that proves to the court, soft serve ice cream, law enforcement, it's not intelligence.
I'm sure some of our listeners are thinking, what in the world? Why are we going to the extent? I mean, why not just kill a guy? Because we're the United States. That's not what we do. You know, that's what separates us from the rest of the world. When you were assigned to Afghanistan, what were your responsibilities? Well, first of all, if you would explain what a legal attaché is, and then what were your responsibilities in Afghanistan?
So, is in the '40s, that Hoover started putting out FBI, legal attachés, and the name is vague for a reason, because in the day they're looking for Nazi sympathizers. They're looking for the connections with Nazis. So they started putting, because the FBI is responsible for counterintelligence here in the States.
Right.
So if, like, there's some really crazy, there's great war spy books about World War II and, you know, us and the Brits and everything. And so they put FBI agents overseas at embassies to really look for these connections to the Nazis, because the Nazis were using countries way outside of the theater of war. And they called them legal attachés. You have military attachés. So it sounds like, oh, it's a, you know, someone, the legal system type of thing. Well, it's an FBI agent. It's grown into, I think there's like over 60 legal attaché offices now. So you're the senior representative to the ambassador. Every FBI operation overseas, most of it's like you're dealing with other law enforcement agencies for cases that contain it. Like if they have a case that is back here in the US, they come to you and say, hey, we're looking for this guy. You send leads to field offices, or a lot of times it's stuff in the States that the perpetrators are overseas or an investigation leads overseas, you have all the connections with those law enforcement agencies and you go over and say, hey, we need help finding this guy or this computer that had this, you know, stuff on it. So, and then in Afghanistan, there's, we also run sources all over the world too. There's sources out there. It's not just the CIA running sources. So you now have all this. And in Kabul, it was a lot different because a lot of other stuff was going on. At one point during the war in Afghanistan, there was like 250 to 300 agents doing different things in Afghanistan that you're running. Some of it, when I was with the military over there, I didn't come under the legal attaché. That drove them crazy because you're out doing all kinds of stuff. He doesn't even know about it half the time. But otherwise, you're in on it. So like when I was in Kabul, I helped with a couple hostage exchanges with the Taliban. I actually met with Taliban warlords and commanders in Afghan prisons and had lunch with them on the prison floor. Never got sick, which was amazing. Eating Afghan food made in the Afghan prison on the Afghan floor. But met with them. So they actually know me, still involved in some, you know, trying to do some stuff there. Ambassador Khilzad was doing the peace agreement, was involved in that because hostages were tied to that. And it was, and they did some other stuff with some of those other units. It was fun. It was a good time.
When you, so, I mean, you've had a very exciting career. Talk about, I mean, not just domestically, but what we call OCONUS outside the United States or outside the continental United States. When you come back from Afghanistan and all the exciting things you've done, was it a letdown? I mean, how do you deal with it?
It really was. I volunteered for all those. I said my ex-wife, like it's one of those, like, she kind of probably knew I was volunteering because I would say, oh, they picked me to go again.
Yeah.
But it is an adrenaline, like, it's a high. And what's like, everyone over there is so focused on their work because they're working 7 days a week. Like when I was LEGAT, we worked 16-hour days. Like there was no time off. When I was, it was funny, I never really wore a suit until I was a legal attache and I wore one 6 days a week. That was my ALATs, they didn't have to wear suits, but they expect the ambassador, you go to all the meetings. I had no problem wearing it as my job, but everyone over there is focused. And especially when you're doing military ops, you're just running all the time. And it's right. Like a speeding train. You don't realize you're on a speeding train until you get off it. Like when I was with JSOC, it was the same way. I didn't even live close. I would leave my house on Sunday afternoon, drive to Fort Bragg. I'd be there Sunday night to Friday, come home for a day and a half. Sometimes I worked through the weekend, slept in my, like it is. I was only one deep. It's not like the military had a staff of guys that could do it. But the work is so purposeful when you're looking for hostages, when you're looking for terrorists, when you're get the threat stream back to the U.S. and you're putting surveillance on something. Like I remember a friend of mine, an Afghan friend of mine, really good colonel. I'd known him since I was over there, first over there in 2003. I knew him for like a decade, and he's now moved up and he's running the prison. And he calls me and says, "Hey, we had a prisoner start talking about a brother who's an ISIS back in the States, and he's talking about doing something." And within just a few hours, I was talking to my buddy, was the ASAC in DC. We identified who it was and we had surveillance going out. So it was phone call, and I called the two-star General Donahue. I knew General Miller was there. I knew the chief of station, and just get on a phone call, and they all trust you that you're not going to, like, hey, look, we got to do no paperwork. This is what's going on. We'll get to the paperwork later. And they trust you enough to do it. And same thing with my buddy, taking like priority surveillance off of one case onto this one is a big deal. And it's funny because I briefed about 150 congressmen and senators when I was in Afghanistan, and they just flew over 17 hours. Half of them are like groggy. They're hearing boring numbers of like some of the briefs would drive me crazy hearing them. And I had this whole story about this threat stream. And I would say, and I'd find out, especially the big, like the senior senators and congressmen, they would come in smaller groups. The new ones would come in groups of like 17, and you just kind of talk to them. The smaller ones were just sometimes two and three. So I always knew who I was talking to. And I'd be like, and I'd talk about this threat stream. And I'm like, and this guy lived 4.5 miles from your house. And most of them would like, what? And I'm like, they're like, one, they'd be like, you know where I live? I'm like, yeah, I'm the FBI. Come on. Two, yes, I looked it up. The guy that we're looking at lived 4.5 miles from your house. And that would, and the other thing is funny because they don't remember all the stuff that people are briefing. And I came up with is ISIS and Al Qaeda at the time. And I made the comparison. I said, Al Qaeda is like IBM and ISIS is like Uber. And they look at me like, what? And I said, Al Qaeda is a very centralized controlled terrorist group. And when someone has an idea, it goes up the chain, it goes to certain people, it gets approved, it comes down. So that when you hear about that threat stream, where it is in the approval process, and you can tell how long it is until they're like operational. You can literally, because they're so controlled. ISIS is like Uber, where you just take an Uber sticker, you throw it on your car, and you do it in the name of ISIS, and you're good with it. And the problem is, when you hear of an ISIS threat, you don't know if they've told anyone or not. And if they're not talking to anyone, there's no way you could get it. So you get this threat. You don't know where they are in the process of doing it. And the same, the one that we talked about in DC was, he could be going out that night. And the threat stream is he was going to attack a nightclub. And we don't know if it was going to be with a car or with a device, but he was going to, and when they looked, they get on him and they do pen register, which looks at, you're not context of call, but who he called. You get the numbers that he called. One of them was a nightclub.
Hmm.
And it was like, holy cow, is he going to do it tonight? Like, that's how, like, you don't know. And that's the difference between ISIS and Uber is, ISIS and Al Qaeda was centralized control corporation. They don't do anything without certain approvals and everything goes on and you can predict when they're going to be ready. And ISIS was, they were just telling people, get cars and drive into people. So you don't know where they are in the process of actually doing it. And it takes more resources until that. So I remember the Ambassador Bass, when I first said that, he kind of looked at me like shaking his head, like, what? And when I explained it, I think everyone kind of got it, like who'd been in that thing. And I remember about the first time I said it, about a week and a half later, I get a call from a FBI SES, or I think it was assistant director. He said, did you really compare ISIS to Uber and you know, Al Qaeda to IBM? I'm like, yeah. And he kind of like, why? I said, well, they obviously remembered it. And that was my whole goal, was someone told you about it. So I don't think they remembered from that 17-hour flight there and back, except maybe that craziness. It was in that, so it was one of those things that was fun.
Absolutely. And that's, I mean, that was the whole thing. You created an analogy that made them remember.
Yeah.
That's, and that's, so a lot of people question, why does U.S. federal law enforcement have agents and analysts outside of the United States? And right there is a perfect example why, because you develop the contacts. One of the best things that the Bureau has is the National Academy.
Yes.
Because I mean, I don't know if you ever knew Dale Watson with the Bureau. Yeah. So Dale and I we did some work after we both retired. Actually, with SEAL Team 6 down in Dam Neck, Virginia, and it was classified 3-day class, but it wasn't anything tactical or operational. And he told me, he said the Bureau keeps this huge manual of everybody that's gone through the National Academy, because when they need somebody in Dubai or Djibouti or Moscow or wherever it might be, who went to the National Academy, and they call them. And that's what it is. It's making those relationships so that you have the network and the contacts when you need something that gets done.
And that was Hoover's mission. He wanted the locals to have some loyalty to the Bureau, to a point, because there's like, we can be very one-sided and it hurts us that way. I was actually a counselor in National Academy. I came back when I was in Afghanistan as a ALAT. And I had some time before I was going to go back to HRT, and I've always wanted to do that. It's a GS-15, though. It's normally like a GS-13 agent. And they're like, you're 15. I'm like, it doesn't matter. I'm going to live in the rooms. And I had there's 250 people in a session, and then the session's broken down to like six sections. And I had one as a counselor, like you kind of like, I wouldn't say babysitter, but you oversaw those guys. You weren't going to class with them. You were doing, I did all the PT with them. I did all the lecture halls with them. And you get this network, and we still have a WhatsApp of all those in our section. But the bigger thing is I'm a member of the association and I can get on the computer and anywhere I have a problem. It's funny. This one guy was telling us a story. His daughter was going to school up in Minnesota. He was from like Southeast US, like Georgia or something. And the daughter's ex-boyfriend was just doing some stalking and doing some really scary stuff. And he just got the National Academy out, saw that the chief of police had been in. If you look back, my yellow brick is right back there. It tells you what section it was. So when you do this run, you get this yellow brick and it has your session on it. And he saw the chief of police's session is probably like 20 years before he was there. He calls him up and he says, "Roger that." And two cops go out and explain to that young man exactly what would happen if he kept it up. But that's what the Bureau does in general. Because
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Welcome to Moto Casino, where the excitement never ends. With thousands of the hottest free-to-play social casino games, fastest payouts, and the best promotions in the industry. No tricks or gimmicks. Owned and operated in the USA.
Moto Casino is a free-to-play social casino. No purchase necessary. 21 plus to play. Void where prohibited.
Sign up today for a generous welcome bonus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
This is Matt Rogers from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
This is Bowen Yang from Las Culturistas with Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang.
Hey, Bowen, it's gift season.
Ugh, stressing me out. Why are the people I love so hard to shop for?
Probably because they only make boring gift guides that are totally uninspired. Except for the guide we made.
In partnership with Marshalls, where premium gifts meet incredible value.
It's giving gifts! With categories like best gifts for the mom whose idea of a sensible walking shoe is a stiletto.
Or best gifts for me that were so thoughtful I really shouldn't have.
Check out the guide on Marshalls.com.
And gift the good stuff at Marshalls.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
When you go to, same thing in DEA, in your class, you have a special relationship with everyone in your class. And then they go throughout the United States and they go do all kinds of stuff. And if you got a problem and like, wait a second, I went to, you know, class with this guy in this office, you just get on the phone and call him. You have that connection with them. And that's what that gave to local police, that they now have this connection worldwide. Like if I need something in, you know, Singapore, there's 40 or 50 international students per class. You get on the phone anywhere in the world and they all remember the National Academy class. They do international. They all say they need to get new livers after the class. You know, it is kind of, you know, it's a bunch of cops being away from home. It can get crazy, but it is one of those things that really is great in law enforcement. It's one of the things I told people after I did it, saying, look, before you get out, you have to go be a counselor. You have to do it because you can get in the association at that point and stuff like that. And you meet unbelievable people, and then you have this connection to everyone worldwide.
It's fantastic. They've the National Academy has started bringing my old DEA partner, Javier Pena, and I, and we come in. In fact, we're going next week, we're recording this several weeks ago when you folks hear it, but it's the first week of December. It's the second time we've gotten to go up, and I think it's class 296. We did 295, I think, in August. So they're starting to bring us in, and then the state chapters. Because the National Academy, they have their state chapters associations, and the state chapters are starting to bring us in for their annual conferences. And it's just, man, it's like you get to kind of, I was a cop for 38 years. I get to live vicariously through what the real cops out there are doing now. It just keeps that camaraderie and that association going, that's one of the hardest things when you retire from law enforcement is you worry, are you still going to maintain that relationship with all your brothers and sisters in law enforcement? And you have to work at it, but it can be done. So just good stuff. Now, so you're back at the academy, and I read where you got involved with a counter drone program.
So when I was LEGAT in Kabul and COVID came up, I was interviewing to retire, and I had a couple of jobs. It was down to like two jobs, and then COVID hit, and both those went away. So I had to go back to the Bureau, and wasn't sure. I didn't want to go back to HRT. I'd done kind of everything that I wanted to do. And they were going to send me to some like financial crime, like something I like had no business doing at headquarters. Cause they didn't like, I had to go back as a 15 and I might've called my buddy who's the deputy director and said, like, knock this off. This is not right. Like I just did 18 months out here, which is giving me 4.5 years of total time in Afghanistan. And you're going to send me back to some. So he got me back down the CERG. They didn't even know what to do with me. And then at one point they're like, hey, look, we got this counter drone program. We kind of need, it was a mesh. It came over from our technology division and they just needed an operational unit chief, someone to run the ops. I didn't know anything about it, but I like to be very technical. I ran the HRT tech shop for a while. And I said, great, sounds good. And I learned more from those guys. It's funny though, because it was during COVID, but we were still traveling, doing everything, like kind of the only ones out there. And I'm a doer. Like if I'm going to learn, I'm going to do it with you. And it's a lot of equipment that you have to put on high places at times. And like I turn everything into a contest. So we're carrying all this electronic equipment up. We're going to a prison in Indiana again for those executions. And we had to climb up on this tower to put all the antenna array and stuff up there. And there's a whole like two vans of stuff. So, and I forget how many, four or five stories or whatever. So I just hit my watch and I come down. I'm like 37 seconds, beat it. And they're like, what? I'm like, I carried my box up in 37 seconds. See who else can. And like, are you serious? I'm like, yeah. I think they respected that I was actually carrying equipment up. And I asked so many questions. What does this do? What does this cable do? And they would probably say, I actually just talked to one of them yesterday. A bunch of them have retired since then. Unbelievably smart, unbelievable guys. And I actually got into counter drone. I was an advisor on a counter drone company. I do consulting calls with it now because it's really neat. But it took me about 6 months on phone calls because you're at COVID, so you're doing all these Zoom calls and stuff with FAA and all these other folks. And I didn't know what they were saying for like 6 months. Like I would be looking up or after I'd write all the words down I didn't understand. I'd call Tom or Casey or Matt. I'm like, what the hell is this? And they'd take the time to explain it to me. Or a lot of times we were driving places because again, flying during COVID and we're driving 9 hours and I'm just listing questions of these guys. But I learned more in that about year I did it than any time in the Bureau. It was literally like a ramp. I remember though, at one point I was the unit chief or the operations chief for 3 weeks and I had to go brief the director on FBI's counter drone program because everyone else was tied up or whatever. And I'm like, great. And it was, they coached me well enough that I went up and did it. No. It's funny. Cause at one point they were talking because half my unit was down in Alabama at Redstone and Senator Shelby was giving FBI incentives to move more. It makes sense to get things that don't have to be around DC out. Just it's cheaper. But I mean, it's kind of like CGIS where our fingerprint system was put in West Virginia because Senator Byrd said, I'll get you the money, but you got to put it in my district. I mean, that's just the typical thing. So Shelby was again, giving incentives for the Bureau to move more jobs down there. Half of my unit was out of there because of the bomb techs and stuff like that. So the director starts talking, I'm asking for my budget was like $9.5 million. And they didn't want to give me anything, but in that, like the director asked one of the chief financial officer, the guy who handles all the money, something about like, well, he's talking about Shelby, like, well, don't we get another $1 billion if we do this? And I'm like, I can move that there. And so at the end of the brief, the director's like, well, he's like, what? He said something. I said, look, what I got out of this brief is I got $1 billion coming because I'm moving the course I talked about down to, and he looks at me. And I said, I'm kidding, boss. Like, I get it. I'm only getting $500 million.
You got to have a sense of humor.
You do. He laughed. I don't think the CFO laughed, but money guys don't laugh.
Yeah. Well, and they're thinking, you're an accountant. You majored in accounting in college.
Oh, it's funny. I never did accounting. Like, I just majored in it and moved on. But when I got to HRT, the FBI didn't have any auditors. Like that wasn't a position at the field division. So me and Billy, my sniper team leader, who's also an accounting major, but I think he actually did accounting for a little bit. He was former Green Beret, went to college, got an accounting degree, was doing accounting and joined the Bureau. So now he's my sniper team leader. They tasked us to do all the credit card, the travel cards, and the purchase card audits. So like we would go do sniping work in the morning and then go audit the credit cards. And then I would see like all the people that were delinquent on their credit cards and stuff. I remember looking at one of them. Cause if you didn't pay within, it's funny, they had to pay you in 5 days for a trip. Sometimes they'd like want to get it for like 30, but if you missed your credit card payment by like an hour, they were like, the supervisor's calling you. I'm like, hey, when you pay me, I'll pay them. They're like, no, that's not the way it goes. I'm like, you have 5 days to pay me and it's been 21. Like I started knowing all the audit rules, you know?
After they created a monster.
And there's this like FBI travel card, like your credit card, personal one, and it's owed like $39,000 and it's 180 days delinquent. And I'm like, hey, I didn't see like, oh, you're not supposed to see. It was a guy who was under OPR, internal investigation, obviously.
Yeah. Sorry. So after 26 years, you decide to pull the pin. What was there a reason for that?
It was one of those things. It was just time. Like I said, it's a young man's game. You have to retire between 50 and 57. I didn't do it. Like, you have to check certain boxes to get SES. I've been a GS-15 for, I don't know, 10 years, more than that, maybe. And I didn't do all the checkboxing to become an SES. There was one job I wanted. I was told by even a friend, like, oh, you didn't do the typical Bureau BS to rate an SES, so screw off. I'm like, well, thanks, because I'm actually more qualified than anyone. And the last four people in that job, I've taught how to do the job. And I just said, hey, it's time. I'm starting to get bitter on some of it. I did make a mistake. I went with a company based on title and salary and then figured out it was like a horrible company. It was toxic. They lied to me about what they really wanted. And now I'm scratching at like a software startup, security consulting, which is a horrible, it's not fun, and doing some other things. So, but I learned my lesson. Like, it is more important who you're working with and what you're doing than the nice salary and the title, so to speak. But it is what it is. Like I said, everything in life comes at it for a reason or whatever.
Right.
You got to learn your lesson before you move on. Every setback ends up turning out to be something that should have happened.
So do you want to say the name of your company or you want me to say it?
Sierra One Consulting. That's one of them. I also, Sentry Ops, is another one. It's a cyber company. I'm with a couple former NSA and agency folks, small, but we do a bunch of cyber stuff. And then White Rock Technologies is a company that's a software startup where we grab encrypted apps. So for sources. So if your sources is, communicating on encrypted apps, you normally have to like go to the phone, take pictures of it. We grab it remotely. It's consensual. And it puts it into a searchable database, your keywords and stuff. And your source can't hide messages. Even if they get deleted, we see them and stuff. And then
nice.
It also applies now, like if you look at the private sector, a bunch of big financial institutions get fined for off-channel communications because all their communications are supposed to be archived 5 years. So investment banks and stuff like that. And the clients, a lot of them want to talk on Signal and WhatsApp. And again, if I'm invested $40 million and I want to talk on WhatsApp, I'm going to do it. But companies are getting fined $150 million. So if you go with our software, we can get those encrypted apps archived. And we can do it on a corporate phone where it gets all of them, or we can do it on a personal phone where you just select how you do it. And so I think we're about to, you know, do it. Because also government agencies have to, again, Federal Records Act, save all their communications. So the Bureau's phones, you can't download Signal. You can't download WhatsApp. It's not allowed. So a lot of times they have personal. So we're now working with government agencies to be able to, again, archive Signal, WhatsApp, because it's safer than text messages. Chinese have the Chinese have infiltrated our text message system and email. Everyone is, they compromise Microsoft's executives on email. Email is just so popular to go after. But Signal is one of the safest ways to communicate, but it can't be archived. Well, we have a way to do that. So we're now in talks with a bunch of government agencies to be able to use like Signal or WhatsApp to communicate and archive it so that you're on the right side of the law, so to speak.
Yeah, I'm looking at your the Sentry Ops Technologies, a leader in counter ransomware.
Yeah, so I went through the FBI's negotiator course. So yeah, so if you get in, if the bad guys get in and encrypt your data, they'll ransom it. They're in it for business. You got to pay them a certain amount, type of thing, to get your keys back and stuff like that. So do that and do some other cyber email business email compromise, and they go in. They're starting to use AI now to make the messages look like it's coming from the CEO. They'll change banking records the last second. We've saved some clients some several hundred thousands of dollars that they were about to send to the wrong accounts and stuff.
Jeez.
But AI is the same way, like a lot of it with voice and stuff. And I had one summer where three of my kids were in Europe, and we all have distress words. If they say a word, I know something's not right.
Right.
If they call me a certain name, it's not right. And then if I'm not sure it's them, I will ask them a question. And the question that I ask is not the right answer, is not really the right answer, because AI can find the right answer. So we have a woman, I think, transferred $25 million based on AI. I think it was a deep state video of her boss and stuff. But constantly voices now are like, especially with family offices with high net worth individuals, if the boss says transfer this money and it sounds like the boss, they're doing it. And so I'm going back to him and say, you have to have an authentication. It's like when you trained, and if you got captured by the bad guys, there's a whole list that you write, like what was your car in high school and stuff like that, that to verify who you are. Same right. thing, but you can't do the truth because AI can find the truth, is what I teach them and stuff. So I do some courses for groups of people just on what's the latest threat out there. I'm doing the stuff now, like I said, contract with MSNBC. I'm actually trying to talk to them about a podcast. I had my podcast Inside the Line with Rob. I kind of put it on pause, and I'm going back to MSNBC to do one with them to see like a national, like meet the press or, you know, something like that. But it's on national security, law enforcement, and I want the end of it to be talk about the latest in cybercrime, like, you know, the thing saying you owe tolls and stuff like that, all the latest things coming on your phone, just to talk about it so people are aware, like, wait a second, that is a, you know, scam. So I'm in discussions with that.
Excellent. You know, and I mean, our listeners just got some free advice on how to prepare your family there with the code words. We had those when our girls were young and in high school going to parties. You know, if they called and asked about their grandfather, well, he's been dead for a number of years. Now with AI, that's probably not the right choice of word, but
That's why you got to get that false one. But I, like, my kids went to Europe. I bought them all like four extra Apple AirTags. Mm-hmm. And keep this in your pocket. Keep this one in your luggage. Keep, like, because again, they may take your phone. They're not thinking right now of the AirTag in your shoe or something. And I actually work with the Foley Foundation, which was a journalist that was killed by ISIS, and Diane Foley started the Foley Foundation. Its first goal is to train journalists for safe travel, and then the other one is to advocate for hostages in overseas illegal government detentions. But we have a guide on journalists' safety, but it's general overseas safety. Like, you don't walk around with your phone. People just look at their phone. You're not paying attention. You're not looking, and you label yourself as a tourist a lot of times by the way you act. So I give some pointers in there how to travel safer, type of thing.
Excellent. Excellent. And I didn't mention it just at the beginning of today's episode, but you guys are not seeing Rob, I guess, live on the video portion of this because of his contract with MSNBC. But,
well, it's MS Now. MS Now. They changed
MS
it.
Now.
They separated. So it's MS Now. Yeah.
Very good.
So, yeah.
So that's why we're showing pictures. And he.
Yeah, I can only do audio, but I want to do the show. So
I certainly appreciate it. So I was looking for awards for you, and I feel pretty confident there's a ton of those out there. The only thing I could find was the FBI and RCMP awarded you with the highest medals of meritorious achievement. And I know you don't want to brag about yourself, but can you at least explain what those are?
The FBI's medal for meritorious achievement was for the pirate incident. And then the Canadian one was we helped get Colin Rutherford. The Taliban want to release him, and I was part of dealing with the Canadian ambassador, but the deputy prime minister of Qatar. And then I end up talking to the Taliban on the phone. A friend of mine, JT, he was an HRT guy embedded with the Ranger unit. He was over in Bagram. I was an ALAT over there at the time. He came over to do a TDY for me, and he ended up embedding. And the RCMP guy, I got him on the helicopter with the Rangers, and they went and flew and picked him up. But it was a crazy story. I'm talking to the Taliban, like the Qatari prime minister, deputy prime minister. Like, it was going too fast. We're trying to find a helicopter. Weather's coming in. We almost landed in a wedding and all this other stuff. And they weren't supposed to have guns on their cars. And they had – anyhow, I'm dropping the Predator down. I'm IMing the guy. I'm in a military jock. IMing the ops director to drop the Predator below the cloud deck. And then the Taliban are screaming because they think it's going to shoot them. And I'm telling them to calm down on the cell phone because the Qatari guy just put the cell phones opposite. And the Taliban guy actually spoke fairly good English. And as our helicopter's coming in, they got the quad anti-aircraft guns on them. And I'm like, they're like freezing. And like our guys, quote, don't have guns, but they're, you know, hidden. And I'm negotiating like, all right, put your hands down if they're not going to land. It's just, but the Canadian, he was held 5 years and they got him back. And that was the Canadian one.
That's a miracle. It's a miracle. Yeah. He's still alive.
Yeah.
Wow. Are there any other awards that you'd like to mention to us special? See, I know. Toot your own horn. It's not worth tooting, right?
I know lots of people that did lots of things. And, you know, like I said, they were all fun. Do them again in a second.
All right. So I'm going to let you go here in just a couple minutes. But before we do, just want to ask you, do you have any words of wisdom that you'd like to leave everybody with? Like maybe for people that are considering a career in law enforcement or military, or just any advice in general?
It takes a long time. You got to have the determination and perseverance to do it. You're going to get told no or whatever. It's one of those things. I talk to everyone, like, one, find something that you like to do other than that, because you just, sometimes it just doesn't happen and you got to still be happy. Major in something that you're going to do well in, because a good GPA, like the Bureau takes people from all over different things. A good GPA is better than a 2.0 in something that you like, so to speak. Or something you think you should do, but computers is where it's going. You know, cyber is so big. And there's lots of different aspects of cyber that are in there too. But the biggest thing, if you're going to do law enforcement, you have to have the thing to serve others. I mean, that's what it's about. Your safety. I can get critical on some of these school shootings that the cops don't go in the building, and I'm sorry, but that's what you're paid for.
Exactly.
It's one of those things. I don't know how you stand there and let some of that happen. It's one of those things, but you're there to serve others, though. I do hold cops accountable, though. Like, I see some of these videos now, that there's so many videos out there, and some of these cops are just like, they're instigating what like they're doing, and they have to remember that they're dealing with people themselves. And that's, when I was young, I had a different attitude. And after going over Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, trust me, we were hitting a lot of wrong places that people were just trying to live, and you got deals coming in, destroying everything. And that's not, you know, that's not great in itself. Are you making more enemy? There's a commonality between humans, and that's the biggest thing. Like, if you're a cop, you're there to serve. Yeah. Some of the videos I see, I'm like, I don't know how you're punching that person. Like, what are those ones now? They're travelers. They don't say they don't have the driver's license. I look at those videos and I'm like, oh my God, the cop is so patient. And then sometimes I see it the opposite, where like, I'm like, that cop is not doing what he should be doing. And we have to hold them accountable. That's you just, there is a thin blue line, but you can't just totally close your eyes to that type of thing. And it's on, the burden is on us as, or was on us as police officers to do the case right. I would rather have a guilty person on the street than an innocent person in jail. I can't imagine being thrown in jail for something I didn't do. And, you know, you can't get your case out type of thing. So you have to be careful with that. But I don't know if I have that many words of advice, so to speak. I do get guilty when people thank me for my service. And I don't mean it in any other way, that I had a great time. Like, even the Marines taught me a lot to do. Like, I wouldn't be where I am today if I hadn't gone through boot camp, got some discipline type of thing. And then my FBI career, like Forrest Gump. I mean, I just loved doing everything. I met unbelievable people. I got to do great stuff. And you know, I'm grateful for being allowed to do it. You know, and I get it. Like, people want to thank you for your service, but I like I said, I feel guilty at a point.
I'm with you. Cause we did it for the excitement and the adrenaline rush.
Yeah.
And it just, I mean, you start your career and it was for me, and actually most every law enforcement officer I've ever spoken to went in with the idea they wanted to help people. There was no, yeah, I want to go in and kill somebody in the line of duty. Nobody does that. Well, there might be occasionally, but that's the one rare, I mean, extremely rare incident. And it's the same with the military. I don't think that most of them go in with a desire to kill people, but they have a responsibility. You got to live up to that responsibility.
Yeah. I do know that there's some of them are really good at it. But I always say that the top tier units are paid for the shot they don't take.
Yeah.
So when you go in, I can, like, if I'm going into hostage rescue, I can, like, anybody moving, I can say is a flirtative move and put a couple rounds in them. Like that's not hard. It's the one where you don't take it because something tells you, like, that's not a threatening thing or whatever. And that's what you really get paid for, is the difference in that, and taking the exact shot that you need to.
Yeah.
Because again, but it's maturity. Like, when I was a young kid, it's kind of like, with young cops and, like, young sports figures that are making $20 million and you get after them because they have a Bugatti car and, you know, they're doing stupid things. I'm like, well, if you gave me $40 million at 20 years old, I don't know what stupid stuff I would, it would have been really dumb. Like I wasn't ready for $40 million at that age. And it's the same thing with a gun and a badge. Like, that is a huge responsibility. And to get it, like, when you come out, like, some of the police officers are young, and it is one of those things, and it gives you this power trip. It is something like, you know, when you're, you know, getting on a plane with a gun because you're an FBI agent, you're the only, like, but it's a responsibility, and that's the biggest thing. And when you get mature, it comes out differently, it's type of thing. And you can't hide behind, like, because it does become us versus them at times. You have that attitude, yet you really have to step back.
Yeah. And those people you're talking about that don't want to have the driver's license, I think those are the sovereign citizens,
yeah,
is what they
it.
Call
yeah.
themselves.
I'll watch an Instagram video, and you know how the algorithm works. The next thing I know, I got these 20, you know, things, and I'm like, I'm so frustrated watching this. How are you not? Why aren't you beating them? But again, it's the stupidity. Like, I know my rights. I don't have to have a driver's license. And the guy's like, yeah, you do. Like,
yeah,
that's just stupid. Yeah.
You can think whatever you want to, but here's the truth. All right. So if people want to find you, let's see, let's go through this on Instagram. You can find Rob here at Sierra One Consulting. And you can also find him Inside the Line with Rob. And that's the podcast that he's talked about. I looked up, you've got several episodes, but you say you've got it on hold right now.
Yeah, I think I did four. They're pretty good, but I put it on hold because this stuff came up with MSNBC, and I just I didn't have the time at that point. But I'm again talking to them to try to relive that one.
Right. And you can see those on YouTube, Inside the Line with Rob. That's the name of the show, Inside the Line with Rob. On Facebook, I found you at Inside the Line with Rob and Robert D'Amico. And last name is spelled D'Amico.
Yeah.
On X, I found you at Rob_Sierra1. LinkedIn is Robert D'Amico and Sierra One Consulting. And your website is Sierra One Consulting. Take a look and see. I mean, here's a guy with unbelievable amount of experience. He's talking about ransomware. He's talking about hostage rescue. He's talking about fraud. If you're a business owner, those are things you really, really need to be aware of nowadays, because you never know who's going to come after you.
I have a lot of my news clips on. Like I said before, I was doing, I would do 8 or 9 different networks at a time. But on my website, there's a bunch of news clips on there. And then some other ones, Jerry Williams, I did that long one on. I'm trying to think what else.
Yeah, and for your listeners there, check out Jerry's podcast. It's FBI Case File Review is the name of it.
Yeah, it's a good one. She started like, 10 years ago? It's like, she's one of the original ones.
Yep.
And just great. And then I found out I'm on ChatGPT knows me. It's fun.
It's like, is that good or bad?
I don't know. It's just, it is what it is. I mean, it's inevitable, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah, Jerry and I are getting together for PodFest 2026 here in Orlando in January. We're going to team up and hang out. And she's going to celebrate her 10-year anniversary as a podcaster. And I won't tell you what that's going to be.
Talk to someone and get up there and check you guys out.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. That'd be great. So, everybody, listen, Rob, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I know the guy's trying to run a business, and I'm taking up over 2 hours of his time to come in here and tell us some more stories.
MSNBC had hit me up to come on air about something, and I'm like, oh, I didn't see it until like an hour after they sent it. I normally don't like silence my phones, and now I got to go back and see what I missed. But it's good. All good.
You tell them you were on the Game of Crimes with Murph in the morning, and they'll understand.
Okay.
But, Rob, thank you, buddy. Thank you for your time. Thank you. Not to embarrass you, but thank you for your service to our country. You were a public servant, and you carried that title proudly. Not something to poo-poo or be ashamed of. Something to be very, very proud of.
Thank you for yours.
I know it's embarrassing. But to our listeners, folks, thank you so much for coming back. If you're listening to this and you haven't checked us out on YouTube yet, go over, log into YouTube, type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar. You'll see the show pop up there. Click the subscribe button for me. We're trying to grow the channel there, and it's I don't know what's going on, but it's taken off a little bit for me. Listen to some of the episodes or watch some of the episodes. Hit the like button and send me your comments. But I do know, I say this at the end of every show, and I know why you keep coming back. And it's the same reason you're listening to today's show, because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all. And you heard it today. It's the Game of Crimes. God bless. I'll see you next week.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
This holiday season, reach for the one butter that never disappoints, Kerrygold. Made with milk from grass-fed cows on Irish family farms, it's rich, creamy, and perfect for baking. Whether browning butter for cookies or crafting the flakiest pie crust, Kerrygold's high butterfat content makes all the difference in flavor and texture. Holiday treats will taste extraordinary.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.